You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Wrestlon.
It's a big one.
It's the end of the trial, baby! Today we're going to be talking about the fourth and final serial of the 23rd season of Doctor Who, The Trial of a Time Lord, Part 4, Episodes 13 and 14, The Ultimate Foe, Parts 1 and 2. Which consists of two episodes that aired from November 29th, 1986 to December 6th, 1986.
True facts!
And I want to give a special shout out to Matt Golden for sponsoring these episodes.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
Golden!
You can check him out at matthewgolden.net. And joining us today, we have all of our returning Trial of a Time Lord guests.
Woohoo!
And one new person. So we have, first off, Christine Cherry.
I'm the new person.
How much are you aware of this trial, Christine? How can you be on the jury if you weren't there for any of the other serials?
Here's the thing. I thought, what if at the very end, we just suddenly did a totally different thing? You know?
That's on theme.
Like, I can just be here completely disconnected from everything that's happened before. Just, you know, that's what I thought I would do. Also, really quickly, I don't want to take up too much time, but I do want to introduce Tony.
Thank you! Thank you.
We were discussing introduction order, and Tony was upset that they were not going to be introduced. So, introducing Tony.
I'm glad someone on this podcast appreciates me.
Oh, come on. We all appreciate you.
Next up, we have Terror of the Vervoids guest, Adam Clegg. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's interesting to be back to be talking about more Pip and Jane Baker.
Oh.
Hooray.
And we also have Mind Warp guest Felicity Cousinance. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm back. I'm not quite as enthusiastic about these episodes.
Fair enough.
Last but not least, we have the Mysterious Planet guest, R. Alan Seiler. Welcome back.
Thank you. So I'm the bookend. I got the first one and the last one.
Nice.
Yeah, that's exciting.
It's amazing how alphabetical order was reverse order.
Exactly. I was thinking the same thing. He planned it that way.
Yes, I went back in time and made sure all of your last names.
Damn.
That's very clever, dude.
How's everyone doing?
Good.
I'm okay. I'm getting ready to go to Dragon Con, which is kind of weird because I haven't traveled in over a year and a half.
Right.
I am surprisingly productive today. I don't know how that happened. It was just like I had one of those days where like you start doing a mild chore just for the hell of it, and then you just start doing more chores.
I don't ever have days like that.
Yeah, I wish I knew what that was.
Right?
I have them so rarely that, like, they're, like, worthy of note. But yeah, no, I'm good. I have a new job, which means I'm busy a lot of the time, but not today.
Well, I, too, am going to Dragon Con, and my weekend is being spent doing lots of prep work, so that's kind of fun.
Who are you cosplaying?
I ain't cosplaying nobody.
Do you do panels and stuff?
Yes.
I've
got eight or nine panels this year, and dropped one because I had a conflict.
I think you should cosplay as Glitz.
I mean, that would not be an easy one to put together at last minute because I don't have all of that stuff in my closet. But, I mean, that's a great idea. You know, Andy Teal does a really, really good Glitz.
Does he have a dimmer?
He does not have a dimmer.
That's a very personal question to ask.
I was thinking, should I answer that? I don't know.
So, are we all ready to talk about Doctor Who?
Yes.
Always.
Why not?
Yeah, when aren't I ready?
Wait, this is about Doctor Who?
I've heard it's about Doctor Who. All right, then let's talk about The Ultimate Foe, episode one, which I have called The Keeper of the Matrix.
Very on the nose.
Yeah.
Alternative title, why is this still going on?
Mistrial.
Oh, definitely a mistrial.
Just how ultimate is this foe?
I just now have come up with my titles for both episodes.
Excellent.
Which are, the first one is Bureaucracy Bad, and the second one is Thesaurus Good.
Wow.
Nice.
That seems right.
Oh, The Ultimate Foe. That was a late title, right?
It was, actually.
It was an alternate title for Terror of the Vervoids, I believe. And then they just shoved it onto this one.
Sorry. Just the idea of Terror of the Vervoids being the ultimate foe is not
I was going to say, yeah. Not really.
The thing is, it doesn't even refer to the Vervoids. It's Doland, the guy that turned out to be the bad guy? I guess.
Wow, I think Pip and Jane Baker have, in addition to not knowing the meaning of catharsis, I don't think they know the meaning of ultimate.
Well, I guess
in the sense that
it's the last one.
Yeah, he was ultimately the foe.
If they were going to use that title for Terror of the Vervoids, it should have been the penultimate foe. So what happens at the beginning of this serial is literally a 10-minute exposition dump. Not even joking. That like first
it's not
10
even
minutes.
Like a recap either. It's like, okay, here's all the loose. Well, not even all. Here's some of the loose ends that we have to tie up. I will just say them at you.
Other than one or maybe two model shots of Glitz and Dibber, or not Glitz and Dibber, Glitz and Mail arriving, the whole first 10 minutes take place in that courtroom.
Can you explain that to me?
Nope.
Okay.
Because they basically just recap, hey, Doctor is accused of genocide.
Which we're not going to make any attempt to disprove, it seems like.
No. Well, the Doctor's like,
it's
I
fine.
Think the Matrix has been tampered with. They bring out the Keeper of the Matrix to be like, no, it's not. I'm the only one who has the key to it. The Key of Rassilon. It can't be copied or, you know, only certain people can use it that I authorize. And then two coffin-like pods arrive, and inside are Glitz from the mysterious planet and Mel from the future.
And it's so sad because when that second pod opens, just like Glitz, you totally expect it to be, you know, Dibber, his prison bitch boy. And sadly, it isn't. I mean, not that I was sad to see Mel, but...
I was confused.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of sad because, you know, the typical Holmesian double act doesn't really work when only one of the double act is there.
But to be fair, I don't remember a single thing about Dibber, maybe because he was never seen again.
It does kind of turn him into less like a Holmesian double act character, and that one guy from The Visitation that's like riffing on a Holmes character.
Yes.
But he's missing his double act.
I was just going to say, sadly, Dibber's fate is revealed in one of the past Doctor books. Spoilers for a book that's at least 20 years old. He dies, sadly.
Oh, no.
I would have thought that Big Finish would do a whole, like alternate season with Dibber.
Don't give them ideas. They will.
You think he died, but really, he married King Irkonos.
That's a much better solution.
I heard he actually married the dog boy.
Aw.
What's his name? Dolph or something?
Yeah.
Dorf?
I think it was Dorf.
Dorf?
He was a great warrior.
Isn't Dorf the golf player that
yes,
Tim Conway plays?
Yes, also that.
A very timely reference.
Joe is full of these very timely references.
But you could think that Glitz and Mel would be the Holmesian duo, but it seems like Robert Holmes doesn't want to write for Mel at all. I think she says two things this, like, serial. It's like, why is she even here? I mean, not the serial, but this episode specifically, episode one. Because this one was written by Robert Holmes with a rewrite by Eric Sayward. He rewrote some of the Matrix stuff.
There was a whole, like, sequence recreating, not a Jack the Ripper murder, but it was something similar that they kind of decided not to use. So he did some rewrites on it. But it was mainly a first draft that was left when Robert Holmes passed away. So there was still some work to do to flesh it out, where he only left, like, the bare minimum of notes for the second episode.
And then Eric Sayward sort of did his own second episode and rewrote the first episode to sort of match it. And then was, like, told that he couldn't use the ending, So he said, fuck all y'all. Can't use any of my stuff.
Last episode he ever script edits. I think the last episode he's ever credited as, because I don't think he's credited on the end of in the last episode.
Probably not. I don't know. I never thought to look for that, but no.
I had a look and I didn't see his name pop up. So we're in what I call the Pip and Jane Baker era, because there's no script editor on Vervoids. There kind of isn't on Time of the Rani. Andrew Cartmell comes in later on that. So we have this short episode run apart from the Robert Holmes episode where it is the Pip and Jane era.
I've never and thought it, about that
of,
before.
Yeah, really of all that. The authors, of all the writers not to edit. Or maybe that's, maybe the whole problem is because they were not sufficiently edited.
Yeah,
because
like, I feel like Mark of the Rani wasn't terrible. It was fun.
No, Mark of the Rani is solid. I like Mark of the Rani.
I think that Pip and Jane, you know, especially in that first season, there was kind of a lot of chaos going on with Sixie's character. I really think that Pip and Jane understood the Sixth Doctor better than most of the other writers. Like, they understood him as who he should be, like, as a character.
You know what? I'm with that.
They definitely lean into his sort of theatricalness more.
I've always said that, and I probably said it the last time I was here, that the Sixth Doctor is best when he's played like an aging drag queen.
That sounds like something you would say. But I think, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Which Colin Baker did do when he played Marlena Dietrich in a musical sketch.
Yeah, I know. And that makes sense. But like, there's this sense of like, he's really good at kind of being very imperious, but tired and kind of set in his ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a good actor. I think he shows in this whole season that he's a good actor, but he was, you know, the writing and JNT's opinion of who this doctor should be is what let him down.
He's the real Jodie Whittaker of the classic Doctor Who, isn't he?
Yeah, I could see that.
Because there's definitely parallels with him and Capaldi, too, where they start out much darker and much more abrasive and sort of like loosen up and become friendlier and warmer as their tenure goes along.
But I feel with Colin Baker, it's a bit more by accident than anything.
Well, that was the plan, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what they say. But I always feel a bit of the whole, oh, he was going to be like an onion, they peel back layers. It's the kind of thing people say after the fact. Does that make sense? Because there's never any sense in his era, and particularly in this season, of anything being planned.
You know, that is a great point.
Like, even this episode, I mean, I think you mentioned it when we were talking about Vervoids, that interesting things from each story just get dropped in the next one. I mean, we've always said, like, the genocide thing, it's not going to go anywhere. It's just kind of like, oh, well.
Yeah, like, they keep bringing it up, but they never address it. They're just like, that happened. And they don't, like, deal with the ramifications of it at all.
But they keep saying it.
I mean, you are really left with the implication that Doctor Who thinks genocide is okay under some circumstances. Right.
Well, that was a pretty ultimate foe.
It's a little bit, do I have the right? Yeah, I guess I do.
Sure.
What if that's what the ultimate foe isn't the Valyard? It is, again, the Vervoids, because they do come back in the last episode. They show that footage again. So that's the real ultimate foe.
The real ultimate foe is genocide.
Well, that's the solution to the real ultimate foe.
Now...
Oh, God.
That's what, like, they're saying, not me.
We've got to shut this down real quick.
That's what they're saying, not me. That's what Pip and Jane believe.
Good Lord.
Yeah, no, I just, like, I saw it, and I was like, no, thank you.
So, anyway, back in this episode, Gliss and Mel have just arrived, and they pop in, and the Valyard's like, who the fuck are these people? And the Master appears on a screen behind everybody in the most low-key performance I've ever seen him do. He's just like, oh yeah, I brought those guys in to help out. I'm here to serve justice.
He's also bored by the exposition, and he's the one giving it.
He's like, come on guys, plot forward.
It almost reminds me of William Hartnell's limited appearance in The Three Doctors. He's obviously, you know, ill and can't participate much. But yeah, Anthony Ainley just seems like, yeah, I don't really care about this.
He's probably like, I don't even understand the words I'm saying.
Yeah, there's no way that this wasn't handed to him 30 seconds before they started rolling.
Correct.
Here, sit in this chair, look at this camera.
He's reading cue cards. His eyes just keep ducking out of frame, like looking at the paper. But he says, where are you? And he's like, I'm in the Matrix. Can't you tell by the weird green screen stuff behind me? I have a copy of the key.
Oops.
So he's like, the doctor's thing about the Matrix being tampered with is a plausible thing.
Because I'm in here tampering with it right now.
The doctor's like real suspicious of like why he's helping him. And he's basically like, I don't want the Valyard taking my frenemy spot.
I do like his argument too, that like, it's much better to have a nemesis who has morals than a nemesis who doesn't. That's an advantage that I have, and I don't want to lose that advantage.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But also, like, the Valyard sucks, and I think he knows that.
He's like, this isn't a fun dynamic. The Master and the Valyard button heads. Who cares? And then the Valyard tries to discredit Glitz from being a witness because he's a criminal. And then Mel says, I'm not a criminal. I'm truthful, honest, and boring.
Which fits in with the tone of what we've seen in this episode up to that point.
That's not even exaggeration. She literally describes herself as boring.
She's hiding something. People who do that absolutely got a dark past. You know, like, yeah, I'm dough. I'm boring. Fetish club? No, you've never seen me in one of those. It's like,
And then the doctor questions Glitz, and Glitz just starts rambling about all this stuff from the mysterious planet that I'm pretty sure 95% of the audience at the time had completely forgotten.
I mean, I watched it not that long ago, and I had forgotten.
Have y'all watched on the Blu-ray all the stuff that was edited out of the previous episodes? Because all that stuff does come back. They mention the sleepers, and they mention Andromeda, and they mention all this stuff again in Mind Warp and the Vervoids to keep it fresh in the audience's mind, but it all got edited out. So you're right. Yeah. By the time you get to episode 13, no fucking nobody remembers what was said about the stupid sleepers, you know, 7-8 weeks ago. I mean, it's a completely unworkable situation.
That's really interesting, because I haven't seen the Blu-ray, so that makes sense that it is mentioned before.
No, I haven't. Yeah, I don't have access to it either.
Yeah, you really should watch it with all the edited stuff, and there's a ton of edited stuff out of Mysterious Planet, and it's interesting to watch it with all that stuff put back in place, because some of the stuff that we see makes more sense.
Yeah, as it is right now, like, the stakes have not really been established. Like, even when, like, the reveal is like, oh, the Time Lords did a bad thing, but it's like unclear what the bad thing was. Like, they moved Earth, but it was also like, no one cares.
You know what? It's about 50% off on Amazon right now. I think I'm gonna buy it.
The Earth?
No, the Blu-ray, sorry.
Typical. Jeff Bezos goes to space and look what happens.
Yeah. Oops.
I mean, because by moving it, if I remember Mysterious Planet correctly, by moving Earth, the Time Lords, and we were just speaking of genocide a moment ago, Time Lords kill billions, surely, because the fireball, like, engulfs the Earth. There's, like, only a few tribes left. And this is going to be something else that we see Colin Baker be really angry in his speech at them. Like, one of his probably classic TV moments, one of his best moments. But that's not going to go anywhere. By the end of the story, he's like, all right, I'm off, bye. It's like, these people murdered billions of people. Are you not going to do something more? He's like, all right, see ya.
Basically,
well, who among us hasn't committed a genocide? That's kind of like, cast the first stone, right?
Exactly.
I would have respected the episode more if it was more explicit about that. Or if they just kind of looked at each other like, all right, we're cool.
We've all made some mistakes.
We both did a genocide that cancels each other out. We can't be mad at you. You can't be mad at us. But the basic gist of everything that's said in this is that Glitz says that the sleepers were taking stuff from the Matrix. The High Council caught on and used a magnetron to move the Earth and its constellations?
Remember, Robert Holmes doesn't know what constellations.
I feel like Classic Who uses constellation to mean solar system.
You're right, Christine. I think that they do that in the Fifth Doctor era, too.
In the same way that they say time zone to mean a thing that's completely unrelated to our concept of time zones.
But then they renamed it Ravalox to cover their tracks. And it is also what caused
what
the
fireball. Does moving accomplish?
The spaceship sent to pick up the secrets misses it, which is kind of hilarious when you think about it. It just, like, goes past because they've moved it, like, 5 inches to the left. And it just,
wouldn't
like,
it have been easier just to move the spaceships?
The spaceships?
Well, you think so?
Like... Yeah, that solution seems so oversized.
Or shroud the Earth and its constellation in some way, like put a big curtain around it or something so that they can't see it.
Well, I mean, in fairness, Russell T. Davis does have the Earth moved again, so someone thought it was a good idea.
It's not even the first time in Classic Who that the idea of moving the Earth has been brought up, because it was also the Daleks were going to do the same thing.
I like the Daleks, though, were just going to put an engine in it.
Hollow it out.
That's a very interesting point, because all this stuff that we're talking about is very Terry Nation, because Terry Nation used to use things like solar system and galaxy and constellation interchangeably. Like, he didn't know what any of them meant. They just sounded spacey. And that's exactly what this reminds me of, is those old Terry Nation things. And then moving the Earth around is exactly a plot point from Terry Nation as well.
There's a sort of almost religious quality to the fear that the Earth will not be in the right place in the heavens.
Hmm.
Well, we are the center of everything, you know.
I mean, yeah, it's an expression of that anxiety. We aren't in the right place because we ought to be in the center.
Yeah.
The Master says that the High Council made a deal with the Valyard, aka the Doctor, to tamper with the trial, and in exchange he'd get the remainder of the Doctor's regenerations. He says it so casually that I honestly missed it.
Right,
Glory?
It goes by.
I have so many questions
really
about
even catching
this.
It. And had the Doctor not stopped and come back to that. Did you say the Doctor?
Yeah, he says the Valyard, or as I've always called him, the Doctor. Blah, 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 blah. Wait a second.
Right, exactly.
Me too.
Oh, well, don't expect any answers, because there aren't any.
When I watched this at the time, and as I pointed out in the Mind Warp episode, this was kind of the first Doctor Who that I was seeing in almost real time. You know, it was without years having passed between it airing in the UK and coming to my PBS station. You know, I was going in cold. So I feel like I kind of thought that was a cool idea.
No, it is a cool idea. That's exactly what's so frustrating about it. I'm trying to figure out at what point in the writing they came up with this idea, because as interesting of an idea as it is, the episode itself isn't interested in exploring it at all.
No, not at all.
There's a lot of, like, Timeless Child in this.
Mm.
It's a very similar vibe.
That's like, so interesting that you say that.
We're going to have to see where, if anywhere, the Timeless Child goes, because they still have a chance to do something with it.
That's true. But it's also, there's this kind of sense of, like, we're going to dump a lot of exposition. There's not going to be a lot of exploring anything. But here's a big canon-changing thing that we're just going to tell you. And then we're going to run around in the Matrix.
Right. And the interesting thing about that is that, as everyone knows, Chibnall, as a snot-nosed 16-year-old, he was on a TV chat show after the end of the season, and he basically criticized the entire season and the people who created it and said they were shitty writers and, you know, the audience could not follow this. And he is literally committing the same things on his show that he criticized Doctor Who for.
It's fascinating.
It is. He has literally dug his own grave.
It's almost,
he just keeps shuffling.
This is almost Greek tragedy. This is almost Oedipal somehow.
You're so right. Oh, my gosh.
One of the really frustrating things about this is that they make the revelation of the Doctor's I've always known him, and then you can see that they immediately lose their nerve and they go, no, he's, and I believe Robert Holmes wanted to make him one of the, you know, future incarnations, and then JNT was like, no. So they went, oh, he's an amalgamation of your darker sides, wiggle eyebrows suggestively, somewhere between your 12th and last incarnation, which would actually be between David Tennant Mark II and Matt Smith, I think, if I'm following
Well, it depends on what you mean by final. Like, the word final is doing a lot of work there. I do believe the novelization says 13th, but the show says final.
But the understanding at that time is that Time Lords have 13 lives.
Yeah,
exactly. But they didn't write that, so it leaves it open to interpretation.
Absolutely right.
There is also something weird in some ways about introducing a dark mirror to the Doctor in an episode with the Master.
Yeah.
Who kind of already feels that function, or does feel that function, but...
Well, I think that's why he wants to get rid of him. He's like, that's my job.
Also, this guy's boring.
Another interesting thing is, it's a bit like in Terror of the Vervoids, where the Doctor's like, yeah, I've just been watching my own future, and that's never picked up on at all. But we've always thought that the Master and the Doctor had a fairly kind of chronologically linear relationship, like they met each other in order, but then it turns out, like, the Master's got a relationship with this future version of the Doctor. Which indicates that Ailey's Master has a more complex, let's call it River Song-esque relationship with the Doctor.
But it actually does make sense, though, because, like, Ailey's Master is the one that didn't just regenerate. He stole a body. Perhaps, like, the minute that you steal a body, you're no longer in Time Lord sync or something.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting concept.
He's now running on Android.
I don't think you should ever actually be in Time Lord sync, though. If every one of them are time travelers, the potential to meet any person at any point in their life exists.
But I think that's why. I think, like, there's probably, like, a sense of, like, because that's possible, there's a lot more work, like, about keeping in sync.
Or Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
Either or.
Right. Interchangeable.
Sorry, I was just distracting myself by my comparison of River Song to Ainley, and now I can imagine Ainley's Master saying, "Hello, sweetie," and suddenly I have the overwhelming desire to write fan fiction.
Do it! If it doesn't already exist, you must create it.
There is a gap that must be filled.
Yikes.
The confusing thing to me is that it does seem like they both want it to be a future incarnation of the Doctor, but it's also like, it's an amalgamation. But
does that mean it's created?
I don't know. And also,
that's what,
like,
it sounds like.
Why?
If it is a future incarnation of the Doctor, and they're going to give him the rest of the Sixth Doctor's regenerations, how would he turn into the Valyard if, like, Six just doesn't regenerate?
Also, don't they just have them? I mean, I guess this is not a thing that's been established at this point. Because sometimes it seems like the Time Lords can just give regenerations all willy-nilly.
Yeah, because they did offer the Master that in the Five Doctors.
And that was a big addition to canon. Well, ever since early Tom Baker, you were under the impression that Time Lords naturally had 13 lives.
Right.
Now, it's something that is imbued upon them by the High Council of Time Lords, apparently.
Guys, I don't think Doctor Who makes sense.
Oh god, I've wasted my life.
It took you this long? It took you six Doctors to figure that out.
It might be broken. The thing is, I don't super mind when it, like, contradicts stuff from before and all that stuff, but it seems bad when it's doing it, like, inside the same episode.
I would like it to be consistent per a serial at least, please.
I mean, it's more the frustration. I don't mind when Doctor Who contradicts itself. It does it all the time. That's half the joy of the program. I'm not that fussed on having, like, a tight continuity, but despite the rumors. It's annoying when they don't explore the ideas.
Yes.
And there's so many actually really interesting ideas in this episode that, I mean, okay, fair enough. You know, Robert Holmes died. That's quite inconvenient to explore. But given how the rest of this series has been, even if he, you know, lived and written that final episode, I'm not sure things would have been explored or followed through properly.
Well, you know, there's kind of a history of introducing an interesting plot point and then doing nothing with it. And the interesting plot point lives only as a sentence that's said by an actor on screen. Like in Ark in Space, the Wirren were basically hollowing out human bodies and laying eggs in them. And you don't get any of that in the story. It's just one sentence that's said. And another one is the Dalek story that Peter Davison did, where it's like they were cloning Tegan and Turlough, and they were going to send them to Gallifrey to do something with the High Council and kill off the High. And that's so interesting. Do that story instead of just making it a throwaway line in a larger story that's okay.
I mean, that's the same story where I believe it's like, yeah, we've cloned all these high-powered people in the Earth government, and Davison's Doctor at the end is like, oh, they'll probably fail, it'll be fine, and just go to pose. Just like, yeah, whatever.
It's like you're telling us that there's a super interesting story here, but you're not telling us the story. You're giving us, like, the side events instead.
And I think it gets to the heart of what's wrong with Trial as a whole, is that, you know, in the meta context of what's happening, Doctor Who was on the verge, or was, depending on who you believe, cancelled. And so this is your chance to make your big statement about you coming back. You're like, this is what Doctor Who is. You know, that's literally why they did a trial, because they were on trial, which is either a very brave idea or a very stupid one, depending on how generous you're feeling. But there's no statement about what Doctor Who is. And that's, I mean, I lay that at, I mean, I know Say would like to blame JNT for everything because JNT is conveniently dead, so can't be on the making of documentaries. But Say would, in his interviews, has never given a coherent philosophy of what Doctor Who is. He's like, it's an action adventure show, and that should have consequences. That's not a fucking.
That's not a mission statement.
Philosophy behind a show. That's Blake Seven. You know, the less good. And you know, it's like Terrence Dix. You can describe Terrence Dix's daughter. Doctor. I almost keep saying daughter. I'm very tired and I've had a long weekend so far. Because you know, you've got Never Crew, Never Cowardly, and you can look at his stories that he wrote, and you go, okay, that's his Doctor. You describe Robert Holmes's Doctor. You can describe Andrew Cartmell's Doctor Who. But Eric Saywood's is like, there's guns. People die.
It's very dark and gritty.
But not adult.
But there's not a sense of, like, a vision for what the show could be.
I actually think Eric Saward's episodes aren't that bad. I think they're kind of interesting. But they also seem less interested in the Doctor. It doesn't seem like he cares about writing about the Doctor at all. He just likes doing the stories around it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's during the making of this story that he quits and goes to Starburst magazine and gives an interview, which he slates Colin Baker.
Oh my gosh.
Really goes, not just him, I mean JNT as well, but really goes for Colin Baker. And there's a reason you'll never get Colin Baker and Eric Saward on a Blu-ray commentary together, or even around a table talking. And because he said he never liked Baker, and he's like, I quite like Peter, but I didn't like, but he's not even that keen on Peter Davison, really, but he's just really vicious on Colin. Unfairly so, because it's like, look, mate, you were writing the scripts.
Yeah, and he also didn't like Bonnie. Like, everything that happened during this season, he just got more and more uninterested in and angry about.
To be fair, I feel like, I mean, Bonnie did seem like stunt casting at the time, certainly. And that's what JNT was known for.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she's, I mean, I dislike Perry so much that I like Mel in comparison.
Worked really well in the Vervoid story, though. I thought she was really good, and they paired up really nicely. I would love to have seen more of Six and Mel.
It's just nice to see the Doctor and his companion get along.
There's a thing, I think, that with Mel, where, like, Mel is perfect for a version of the show that they are not doing right now, but is about to exist. Like, Mel is, like, tailor-made for season 24. And I do think that, like, Pip and Jane actually kind of got the thing that Doctor Who was about to become. If you take the first half of Ultimate Foe and the second half of Ultimate Foe and kind of averaged them out and mixed them together, that's kind of just what season 24 is.
Yeah, I can see that.
But it has a purpose. It's got, like, someone in charge who, like, has ideas about what the show should be. So it's kind of fascinating to see, like, all these ideas almost coalescing, and they're just missing a thing that gives them momentum and purpose. And, like, Mel is huge about that, like, is a huge part of that.
Another thing that's really interesting about this whole story and jumping forward into Sylvester is that the whole notion of the series being on trial, they did it for an entire season, and then they doubled down on it two seasons later, which is a spoiler for Joe and Tony. And when you get there, you'll be like, wait a minute, they're on trial again, but not literally in a trial room. So it's a little bit different, but it's exactly the same thing. And I think it's fascinating that 2 years later, they're still worried about the same problems.
Maybe they have a more consistent view of what the issue is then.
Well, it'll be interesting once you see that story. I won't tell you which one, to kind of think back on this whole season and compare how it was done in that story as opposed to the way that it's hashed out in this season.
Back to the trial. It's over. The trial is basically over because the Doctor's like, you can't have the same person be prosecutor and defender. And then the Inquisitor's like, yeah, you can. And the Doctor, and there's the dumbest shot, and I love it so much. It's so fucking stupid.
Oh, yes.
It is so bad.
Where the Doctor just goes, what? And in the background, the Valier just runs behind him like a Scooby-Doo villain or something.
Like,
I don't know.
Nobody noticed him leaving his podium and running around the room. Like, did anybody think, where the hell is he going?
Hitching up his robes and just, like, pecking it around in front of all the juries. And I love it. So I'm glad other people love that shot because it cracks me up every time. Because it's just like, you could just say, time to scarper, lads. And, like... I've been rumbled.
It's amazing.
So dumb and glorious. I love it.
It's interesting how they spend a lot of time kind of through the trial establishing the idea of who the Valiard is as a character, and then immediately drop everything. As soon as he, like, runs out the door, he's functionally a different character.
Well, sure, because he's dropping his own pretense. You're seeing who he actually is rather than who he's pretending to be in the courtroom.
But it's so weird that it's unclear why he's pretending to be that.
Oh, of course. I mean, that part makes no sense at all. Like, what is the point of him actually doing that?
Right. There's no way. No one's thought about this character.
No.
There's so little thought in general.
And also, surely the Inquisitor and the jury, they must be in on it. Because if you're genuinely trying to set someone up to cover something up, you don't select an impartial jury and judge. And again, the Doctor at the end is just like, you can be in charge of Gallifrey. I'm sure you're not massively corrupt. Bye.
Okay, but the other thing is, I mean, if this really was something to get rid of the Doctor and give the remaining regenerations to the Valiard, whoever it is that's doing all this stuff, why not just kill... What's the point of putting him on trial? What's the point of concocting all this nonsense?
I don't know. I mean, are they trying to frame him for the whole... I mean, after they kill him, will they be able to say, oh, he was, you know, he did all that shit? Yeah, that would make sense if they'd ever given any hint of it.
I think that might be in the giant wall of exposition.
I do think it's in there, but it is just told at you. And so anyone who wasn't paying attention could be forgiven.
That big exposition scene reminds me of the big exposition scene in Time of the Doctor, where they just sit down and explain the whole last three seasons of Matt Smith. Same vibe.
See, at this point in the show, in this serial, my brain just said, stop thinking and just watch. And that's how I got through it.
I mean, that's what works for most of 80s Who, as much as I do love it.
I mean, there is a theory, I think it's Elizabeth Sandifer writes about this for Ultimate Foe, that if the Valiard is like the real dark side, the opposite of the Doctor, and if you take the idea that the Doctor is essentially a chaotic character, like turns up, break rules, kicks things over, disappears, then the Valiard is someone obsessed with laws and rules, and that's why you've got all the signing of the contracts, and that's why that's really important. And it's kind of there maybe in the Bob Holmes script. It definitely disappears by the time he's talking about particle disseminators in the next part. But that's quite an interesting idea, that maybe that's kind of what they're aiming for. That's why there's a trial, because it's got to be done properly.
That would be a tie-in with like the whole bureaucracy angle we're about to get into as well, this sort of...
Okay, but this is wild to me.
Of law and order, I guess.
We've got so much shit to wrap up. It's only a two-parter to wrap up an entire season, and we're about to just spend so much of it in a completely different world.
Yeah. Because that's what happens next. The Valiard runs through the seventh door, which is like some really cool like rainbow glass. And he goes into the Matrix. Like there's a physical door into the Matrix. And the Doctor follows him and drags Glitz along for some reason.
Not only does he drag Glitz along, he very specifically is like, I'm taking Glitz. Mel, you stay here.
To be fair, he doesn't know Mel.
That's true.
That is fair.
Like, he's spent more time with Glitz than he's spent with Mel.
And he knows that Glitz is a conniving manipulator and will work well in the world in which they're going.
Mm. But, like, Mel wants to go and Glitz doesn't.
He acts like he knows Mel later, too. Like, he's like, there's a bit where he's like, I knew it, like, this whole thing was fake because you wouldn't have acted that way. I'm like, how would you know? You watched one tape of her and now you're an expert on Mel. You've literally seen her in person for like 5 minutes.
You wouldn't do that. You're boring.
But they basically land inside the Matrix, which is like Victorian London. They hear evil child laughter and singing of, well, not child laughter, it's the Valiard laughing, and there's children singing songs, like,
which is just sort of generically spooky.
The Doctor sticks his head over a barrel thinking Glitz is in it for some reason, and some hands pop out and grab him. It's just so weird. And it's like, you've had all of this exposition dump and all these interesting ideas, and then suddenly just this shit happens, and you're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
And it's not bad on its own.
It's just confusing.
Yeah. And this is some pretty standard Doctor Who stuff of like, we're going to just make fun of bureaucracy for a little bit. And it's like, all right, if this had started here, I'd probably be on board. Here, now, I don't understand.
So Glitz arrives, he doesn't really save the Doctor. The Doctor's already pulled himself out, but he gives him a note from the Master. It just says, this is the Valyard's base. Go there. And it's the Fantasy Factory. And it just illuminates, and it's just this big neon sign that says the Fantasy Factory. Glitz doesn't want to go, but the Doctor's like, you'll be fine. And then a door opens up, and a harpoon just flies out and stabs Glitz. He's fine.
Here's a fun little fact. After Rose broadcast, they have already had series one in the bag. And after Rose broadcast, the BBC went ahead and commissioned series two and three. So they knew that they were going to have at least a 3-year run of the modern show. So they started working on building dedicated studios for Doctor Who and for other productions like Torchwood. The initial name that they wanted to give to the new studios was the Fantasy Factory.
Aww. Nice.
That's kind of fun. You were correct in your assessment of that fact as fun.
I'm so glad it lived up.
I was temporarily possessed by the ghosts of Pip and Jane there.
We briefly cut back to the trial for a minute because they're just like talking, just chit-chatting with the Master. And they're like, how much of this was true since the Matrix has been tampered with? And he's like, most of it was true. The genocide, definitely true. Most of it is true. And then he says, but Perry, the fate of Perry is not true. She's actually married to your Kanos now.
Which is so gross.
It's gross.
The Master has a better idea of what was happening in Mind Warp than Philip Martin did.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
This was added super last minute because, like, Colin Baker was like, what happened?
Yeah, that's weird because it was JNT who demanded that change. Because he didn't like Perry being killed off. And that's a shame because that was one of the greatest companion exit scenes ever done in Doctor Who.
It's definitely dramatic.
So Nicola completely got robbed on that. That was by far her shining moment in the whole 2.5 years that she was on the show.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, she hated it by all accounts. She hated the change. And so has virtually every... Like, there was a new adventure, Bad Therapy, which dealt with her basically... An older Perry basically finding the Doctor going, why did you leave me with Brian Blessed? And there's been Big Finish audios as well. I've done the same thing, basically going like, mad Brian Blessed, why do you think I wanted to be there?
One of the few Big Finish stories that I've listened to was... The Widow's Assassin, which basically takes up Perry's story right after marrying Urkanos. And, you know, Widow's in the title, so draw your own conclusions. I thought it was pretty well done.
Especially because, like, in Mind Warp, she spends a lot of the episode being like, man, I really want to go back to Earth. I love being at Earth. Earth is great. I want to be on planes. Take me to Earth. I certainly don't want to live somewhere else.
I don't know if it's the novelization of Mind Warp or this one. It's revealed that Go to Earth, he becomes a professional wrestler and she becomes his manager.
That's my favorite ending.
Okay, that's amazing.
I'm on board now. I'm on board now.
Never mind. It's good.
See, I actually don't... I think both endings, like, if you do the Mind Warp death ending, I'm not a huge fan of that. I'm also not a huge fan of this ending. But I will say, I think the Mind Warp ending is at least dramatically more interesting.
Oh, yeah, by far.
I do think... I keep comparing this to New Who. I kind of feel like the Mind Warp ending is like the Face the Raven ending. Where, like, it's really well done and it's very well executed. But I don't think it's satisfying for the character. And it's not meant to be. And so, like, it is an ending that's begging for something else. Just not the thing that they did.
Not a flashback with a rose-tinted edge to it.
The Doctor and Glitz enter the Fantasy Factory because Harpoon did nothing because he was wearing armor or something. And they talk to a Mr. Popplewick.
Mr. Popplewick.
And he's like, they're like, we need to talk to J.J. Chambers. Because J.J. Chambers is who's supposed to, like, own the factory. And they're like, well, you need to have an appointment. And, like, he just does a whole bunch of, like, you know, you gotta follow the rules. And then they're like, let's just bypass this and just go into the office. And they go into another office that has another Mr. Popplewick. I thought that was pretty funny. And then they have, it's just this whole big, long, like, it's just the Sunmakers again. It's just Robert Holmes being an old grumpy man complaining about bureaucracy, which is great. But then he basically, there's a bit where the doctor signs away his regenerations to J.J. Chambers in the case of his death inside of the Matrix in order to get a meeting with J.J. Chambers. He goes into what he thinks is the waiting room, but turns out to just be a beach. And the doctor complains about, he's like, where are the outdated magazines? Which I also think is a good joke.
Yeah, that's a great line.
And he's walking along the beach and some hands reach up and grab him and pull him down into the sand. That is the end of episode one. I actually kind of like this effect and everything.
It's terrifying and I hate it.
There is a bit where it looks like he's like scooching down a little bit, like he's helping it along.
Yeah,
they could have edited it a little bit better, but conceptually I think it's great.
Yeah, he definitely rolls into the hands at one point, kind of like, ooh, all right, you got a good grip there, guys. We also get lovely shot up his nose for the final shot of the episode.
One last cliffhanger that goes straight into his nostril.
Right. Right.
And that's the end of episode one, and we are now into the last episode, episode two, episode 14 of Trial of the Time Lord, The Catharsis of Spurious Morality. That's what I call it.
That's original.
It's the dumbest line, and I love it. So, it immediately the tone of this thing just gets wonky. We see the doctor's feet just sticking up out of the sand, kicking back and forth like a cartoon character. And I feel like Glitz's character is suddenly, like way more stupid. And he comes up and he grabs the doctor's feet and he just pulls his spats off, those little orange things. And then he hears the doctor basically saying, like, everything's fine. And he's like, oh no, a voice from the grave. And then the doctor says, or a grave voice. And then rises up out of the sand and says, bad joke. But that's all this is a bad joke. That shot of him rising up out of the sand, that's legitimately cool as hell.
It is cool. I like it.
They did it backwards. He had to learn the line phonetically backwards.
Wow.
So I almost called this episode bad joke backwards. I was going to spell it out, but I didn't. Ecoge dab? Like, they did it three times. He just dunked, they dunked him under the sand. He loved doing it too, apparently. He's like, that was the most fun part of filming this thing.
Movie magic. I will say about the like tone shift between these two episodes, as someone who's written multiple exquisite corpses with you, Joe, the experience of going from these two episodes is so familiar to me. It is so evocative of like the experience of reading an exquisite corpse script, because that's literally what this is. There's even a corpse. R.A.P. Mr. Holmes.
Yeah, because didn't they have to write this in a weekend? They literally got given Pip and Jane got given the script. I mean, you know, as much as this may frustrate, but they got given the script. Don't read it. You can't look at any of the notes about what was going to be the second episode. Can we have that in 2 days? And it almost hangs together for something written that quickly.
They literally had a lawyer in the room with them to watch them to make sure they didn't make reference to anything that Robert Holmes had left behind.
Wait, really?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Eric Sayward said, you can't use any of my script.
Any. I'm taking everything with me. You can't use any of it.
And they had to have lawyers to make sure that they didn't reference any of that stuff.
So, I mean, this was written really quickly and under unusual circumstances. And Pip and Jane were known in the industry for being fast writers. You know, fast and reliable.
Not good.
Pick two.
I will say, I love the tone of this sequence. I really respect the things that Pip and Jane care about, which is that there should be a lot of fun, goofy shit.
They are right about that.
They're interested in narrative only as much as it is a space to allow them to have fun with, like, concepts and dynamics. I think they actually have a very modern understanding of writing in that way, wherein, like, they kind of look at every Doctor Who story as an excuse to, like, a plot is just an excuse to do fun shit.
This is the real time monster sort of vibe.
And like, kind of building a plot around, I really want to do this dynamic. Like, the Mark of the Rani is like, I think it'd be really cool if there were three Time Lords bantering. And we'll build a plot around that. Or, like, I think it'd be really cool if they did a murder on the Orient Express. We'll build a plot around that. And then, like, their next one is built on another kind of like story hook. They're like, they're the only people writing like Doctor Who at the time who are like cognizant of the idea of a story hook.
And that's kind of how Robert Holmes used to work when he was the script editor. You know, it was the story hook idea. Let's have one that's like Frankenstein. Let's have one that's the Manchurian Candidate. So I think that the story hook is just as important to Holmes as it was to Pip and Jane.
Yes, that's very true. It's just they have completely different ideas about what the hook is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the hook brings you back.
Right.
I'm so angry. So in this scene, the Glitz and the Doctor are talking, and the Valyard appears and then just sort of pops around all over the place, like disappearing and reappearing and quoting Hamlet. And then he further muddies the sort of concept a little bit, and he says, like, by destroying the Doctor, he will free himself of those bits of the Doctor he doesn't like. I don't understand how this
works.
Are
they connected?
Sure.
What is...
I don't know what it means. I didn't super pay attention to it when I was watching the scene, because I was just like, this is a neat effect of him just sort of popping up around all the place. But then I read the transcript, and I was like, I don't know if this makes sense. It makes, like, a sense, but not... It doesn't make sense, but it makes a sort of sense.
Yeah, it makes a sort of sense. It makes a kind of emotional, thematic sense.
It's almost dream logic.
I feel like it's more like, you know, it's Pip and Jane's interpretation of what the Valyard is, rather than Robert Holmes's impression.
If it was a line in, like, a Christopher Bailey script, you know, you wouldn't question it. But because it's in the middle of a this, Pip and Jane Baker, yeah, you're right. You're like, but is... And because they haven't been clear on the nature of the Valyard, you know, they've kind of really fudged it. Yeah, you're like, what does it mean? But yeah, you put this in Kinder or something and no one would even blink.
But I would also say, if you put it in any of the next three seasons... If you put this in, like, Ghostlight.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, again, like I'm saying, there is a sense of them prefiguring what's about to happen with dream logic and kind of associative storytelling.
I'm just imagining how angry Andrew Cartmel would be if you told him that Pip and Jane Baker in many ways prefigured his era and worked it out before he did. Curious.
Do you think it's them getting away from the sort of, like, Ian Levine continuity porn sort of idea? And more just weird shit.
Yeah, and like the kind of the tyranny of plot.
Mm. Mm.
But after the Valyard sort of says his bit and then leaves, the Doctor and Glitz run away from some nerve gas that is real for some reason, even though nothing else is.
How would you know that is and everything else isn't?
Good question. That's just how it works in the Matrix. They run away from it and they run inside of a big beach hut that... is actually the Master's TARDIS, which reminded me a bit also of Chibnall with the Master having a house. Actually, there's a lot of house TARDISes in Chibnall's era. There's also a bit where Mel is watching all of this and is like, we gotta save the Doctor! And she tries to run towards the Matrix and she gets tripped by the Keeper.
Can I just say, the Keeper is played by James Bree, who has previously appeared in the War Games and Full Circle. And I wonder if he ever just was sitting around there thinking... I was in the fucking War Games in Full Circle, and now I'm doing this. I'm just tripping up Bonnie Langford. What's happened to Doctor Who?
Right.
And they only have him trip her so that they can set that up and then do it again later, but she's onto him this time. But anyway, inside the Master's TARDIS, he says he wants the Doctor to destroy the Valyard because, you know, that's what he wants. But he's basically thinking, like, they'll destroy each other.
And the Master's TARDIS is really in a goth phase, like, to the point where I half expect, with those black walls, and I half expect the Master to turn around and go to the door, you're not my real dad, you can't tell me what to do. And then he plays his music too loud. So it kind of all goes.
Yeah, him and Glitz sort of go into another room and then just rave music plays and pulsating lights and sounds, and the Doctor pulls a bunch of faces, and the Master explains to Glitz, oh, I've turned him into a zombie. He's under my control now. And so they appear outside of the factory. And they're going to use the Doctor as bait to lure the Valyard out so the Master can shoot at him with the TCE and accomplish jack shit. And the Valyard's like, you think I wasn't prepared for this? And then just starts throwing quills at them, little feathers that explode. It's very nonsensical, but goofy.
Pretty
and
it is cool. The Valyard is like really a Batman villain now.
That's so true.
And while like all these explosions are going on, the Doctor is just standing there vacant because he's been hypnotized, I guess. And Mel shows up and is like, follow me. And I'm in the shadows and it's weird. And they go back to the trial.
I will say that sequence is very well directed.
I agree.
Yes, it is. It lets you know that something's weird.
Because, like, it has to make you feel like it's wrong without saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
It does a really good job. You're like, what is her deal? Like, something's off here.
Especially when we don't know Mel that well.
Yeah. They watch the Vervoid Massacre. Pip and Jane are like, remember this? Remember when we did this? We brought it back. And here's a weird thing. Okay, so, like, it's not Mel. But this fake male does seem conflicted about, like, saying, like, she's like, they're, like, asking Mel, okay, you were there for this. What really happened? And she's like, Doctor, do I tell them? I don't want to get you in trouble. And he's like, tell them the truth. And she's like, he did a genocide, but, like, there was no other option. The Vervoids were going to kill everybody. It was an out-of-this-world
But it solution. Still seemed like that was the actual truth.
Yeah.
Because
it was the actual truth. Yeah.
Yeah, the Doctor never disagreed with that. Of all the things that, like, they say, you know, was the Matrix was lying about, this one was never in question.
And also, but it just also is like, Mel is supposed to be like, that's not really Mel. She's tricking him. But she's still just acting like Mel. And like,
well, it'd be too suspicious.
Yeah, no, it's got to be convincing.
Right, because this whole thing is basically taking place inside the Doctor's mind, and they're convincing him that he should give himself up and lead himself away. They think they are, anyway. He's on to them, but that's their point.
They declare him guilty and that he's going to be, you know, his life is forfeit. And then we pull back from this and we're back into the real trial. That's a nice shot. You have the shot of the trial, and you pull back, and you see the trial.
That was awesome. That was one of my favorite moments of the whole episode.
And Mel's like, we gotta save the Doctor, and she runs, and the Keeper puts his foot out, and then she just shoves him and takes his key and goes into the Matrix.
I actually thought that maybe this was going to be a reveal that he didn't actually do the genocide, but no, he still did it. Because the thing is that, like, the Doctor hasn't actually experienced Terror of the Vervoids yet. So I think it could have been interesting if, like, the Doctor was like, well, I had a good reason. Sort of accepting that, like, that is a thing that I am capable of doing. And I don't know that I didn't do it. But, like, I might do that. So I might as well, like, punish myself for the thing that I feel like I am capable of doing. And then having the reveal that actually, no, you didn't do that. That's almost Day of the Doctor in a way.
Also, can you punish someone for something they haven't done yet? I mean, I guess, like if you're planning on it. But, like, if, you know, that's different than what is happening here because of time travel. But
there's a whole Prince song about that on the Batman soundtrack. It's called Electric Chair. It's an amazing song.
A lot of Batman. There's also, you know, you could just... It's unclear if the Time Lords have precogs.
Ooh, yeah.
Well, at least until David Tennant, then they have one.
That's true, they do have that one precog.
Sorry, just to go back, so we're establishing that Pip and Jane Baker were a definite influence on Prince, right?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's concurrent, so, like, it was a conversation, Pip and Jane on one end, Prince on the other, you know, you give ideas, you take ideas. It's collaboration.
You say we can't consult Robert Holmes' script, but you never said we couldn't call Prince.
So the Doctor is literally carted away on a cart, just standing up in it, too. Very dramatic. Like, it's going through that Victorian London era. And the real Mel rushes up and tells him this is an illusion. And he's like, don't say that. And then the cart disappears and he falls down. And he's like, I knew it wasn't real because I know you, Mel. You said stuff in the trial you wouldn't have known. And he was just going along with it to lure out the Valyard. And there's a really nice shot where the camera just sort of whips around And, like, he's, like, saying some shit about the Valyard, and he's like, that'll lure him out because I'm, like, attacking his nature. The camera just, like, swishes around, and there's, like, a low angle of the Doctor with the big Fantasy Factory sign behind him. It's a really good shot.
Yeah, it really is.
Also, that does remind me, to be fair to the episode, it's not that he knows Mel as a person, it's just he literally knows Mel was not in the room when a certain thing was discussed.
Yeah.
And he specifically mentions her trait of having, like, total recall as well.
Right. But I think they mentioned that in Terror of the Vervoids,
right?
Yeah,
he would have seen that in the VHS that they watched.
They should have been reading the novelization.
It's a real Mel Brooks idea. So the Master, meanwhile, tries to hypnotize Glitz into leading the Doctor to the Valyard, which the Doctor wants to go to the Valyard anyway. Like, they have the same goals. He's, like, doing the little, you know, watch thing where he's... And it doesn't work. The Glitz is just like, oh, I bet I could get a lot of money for that watch. And he's like, okay, how about this? And he pulls out a big treasure chest. And he's like, yeah, I'll work with you for that.
I do like this scene a lot.
Hypnotism will not work. Treasure, however, yes, please. Then there's a weird scene. So the Doctor's like going, Doctor and Mel are sort of going around inside, I guess, Pavlovich's office looking for clues. I don't know. But there's just a door, and Mel's going to open it, and the Doctor's like, don't open that. And she opens it, and there's a dragon there that breathes fire at her. And then he's like, door. Why? I don't understand the point of this scene. It's so random.
I don't know.
And then while they're doing that, Glitz is caught trying to steal the memory bank from another Popplewick's office, I guess. He's caught by Mr. Popplewick trying to steal the memory bank, which is the same thing we saw on the Mysterious Planet, except this one. I think Popplewick says the one from Mysterious Planet was a copy or a fake or something. This is the real one. I don't know. It's all the stuff he was trying to steal from Mysterious Planet. Meanwhile, the Doctor finds a list of the High Council, their names, written on a piece of paper, and they're all crossed out, and it's all in his handwriting. What could that mean?
That apparently handwriting with Time Lord stays the same across regenerations.
Everything else changes, but the handwriting consistent.
But also, how stupid is it to reveal your plan by having a list of the people you're going to kill and crossing off the names?
Prematurely! Don't cross off your chickens!
Before they explode.
Before they've been disseminated.
So, well, Glitz brings Popplewick to the Doctor. He's like, I pulled a gun on him. And they sort of head out, and the Glitz then sort of reveals that he's been working with Popplewick, and they swap the gun and the memory bank, because they made a deal to deliver the Doctor to the Valyard, I guess. But then Popplewick tries to shoot Glitz, but Glitz took out the bullet, so it doesn't work. And then the Master shows up and says, get in the TARDIS, we've got the memory bank, let's go. Then the Doctor and Mel are looking around this factory. The Doctor doesn't trust Popplewick, but in a different way than not trusting him before. He's acting really weird. He's like, yeah, Mr. Popplewick. And then they grab him, they tie him up, and then they just rip his face right off, because it's not Popplewick, it's the Valyard. And they rip his clothes off, too.
And he's got the robes, yeah, he's got the robes still on underneath. That's pretty stupid.
And he would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for those crazy kids.
It's nice to see one of those old rubber masks.
Was he in all the Popplewicks?
Yeah, my impression was that he was Popplewick all along.
But, like, we saw multiple Popplewicks. Was he in both rooms?
There is a scene where we do see the Valyard and Popplewick together.
Yeah.
It's the Matrix. There can be multiple copies of him.
I love the idea that he dressed up as one Popplewick, and the Doctor, and they just got really lucky.
What if they just ripped the dude's face right off?
Or, like, he tried to rip off Popplewick's face, and he kept pulling, and it was just, like, a dude's face. It's like, oh, I guess not.
Austin Powers?
And then he sees another one, and, like, he has to go through, and he's like, on the fourth Popplewick, he gets it.
I like the idea that he tried to dress up as him, and they fucked up, and that's why there were two in the same room. And they just, like, he had to really quickly be like, nope, that's just how it works! It's in the Matrix! Fooled. It's a trick. Fooled ya. It worked.
So they tie him up, and that stops his ability to teleport?
They're magic ropes. You know, they're kind of like, they're like Wonder Woman ropes.
Sure, why not? Even though the Doctor previously told Mel not to open a door, she just runs and opens a big door that has, in giant letters, DANGER on it, but it's fine because it's got a megabyte modem in it.
Do we think this is the bit that was written at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night when they were desperately trying to put this together? Like,
yes.
And they're like, what's a computer yes. term? Monitor? No. Keyboard? No. No, we need something else.
Give me two computer words that are alliterative. It doesn't have to make sense. They just have to be alliterative.
So when Mel was introduced, her basic character outline was that she's from Peace Pottage.
Wait, hold on. Mel was introduced?
You know, like to the press.
At no point was I introduced to Mel.
A character like brief that JNT wrote.
Was that she's from Peace Pottage and she's a computer programmer and she's into the health scene. And this is literally the only thing that we get from her that says anything about being a computer knowledgeable person.
I think in JNT's outline, there's something about the idea that she met the Doctor, because, you know, we never see how she met the Doctor originally, while stopping the Master committing financial fraud. And I'm like, oh, that would have been a thrilling episode of Doctor Who, stock market manipulation.
There's also a really gross thing in that outline as well, which is that she's one of those feminists who...
She's a feminist until things are hard.
Oh. Yeah. Boy. And then she's suddenly like, I need help when stuff gets tough.
Imagine wanting to be treated equally, but also needing support of some kind. The hypocrisy of it all.
But it turns out this megabyte modem is also, or I guess instead of, I don't know, it's a particle disseminator, whatever that means.
It disseminates particles.
That's what it says on the tin. And they realize that the list is a hit list. And that the Valyard is going to kill the trial through the Matrix screen in the trial room. Because it's, like, directed at it. It's going to beam.
This is such a convoluted plan.
Yeah.
It's the same plot as Ring, isn't it? If you watch the screen, you'll die.
Couldn't he have just hidden a bomb there while he was in the trial room for several weeks?
That would have made some sense. So Mel runs off to go warn the trial. Because I was like, get him out of there, because while I work on this, would she just hit stuff and it catches on fire? Then there's like a plot line that, okay, so when I made my notes, I usually look at the TARDIS Wikia and I read the transcripts and all that to sort of like clean up my notes. The TARDIS Wiki mentions a thing that does not happen in this episode, but does happen at this moment. There's a bit where they say the Master set up this thing. He's been... In the TARDIS Wiki, it says the Master has been showing the people of Gallifrey this trial. Like, he's been showing it to people. And then, at this point in the story, the Keeper runs up to the Inquisitor and says that there's a bunch of insurrectionists are running amok in Gallifrey or whatever. Which is a result of that. But that setup is not in the episode. Mm-mm. Is it in the novelization or something?
Yeah, it's so unclear. Also, that's a wild idea that, like, talking of ideas that are just casually thrown out in, like, a couple lines of dialogue, the idea that there was an insurrection on Gallifrey that does not matter.
No, like, nothing really happens from it. It's not set up, it doesn't pay off, and it's just barely mentioned here.
To be fair, that is my experience of insurrection. It's just like a month or two later, and you're like, so we're all done talking about it. All right.
Do you think, like, Gallifreyans were leaving comments on the internet about the trial going, like, this is thematically all over the place. I don't like this plot line. I'm confused. Are you confused? And the Master's trying to get an insurrection going. They go, yeah, but what did happen to Perry? And he's like, for God's sake, insurrect.
It's also sort of interesting that, like, they spend a lot of time. There's a whole giant speech, which we didn't really talk about that much in the first episode, about how awful the Time Lords are and how terrible, like, the whole system is and how corrupt everyone in this government is. And then there's an insurrection and it's like, well, we don't want that.
Right.
No, but it's very clear that we should keep this government in power.
Yeah, that anger at the society just isn't there in that second episode at all, is it? It just vanishes.
It's such a mess. Then the Master calls in and gloats and says he controls the Matrix now. He plugs in the memory bank into his TARDIS, and then immediately, like, Glitz and the Master just slow down and turn black and white, and he's like, it's the I don't even remember what he says. He says some, like, ridiculous, like, you know, some phlebotinum stuff. It's the overthruster. And then they slow down.
They're turned into a missing episode. They're then put in a cupboard in Hong Kong for, like, 30 years.
So, but Mel runs in, warns the council, and they rush out. Most of them do. The guards get out of there super quick. They're just immediately like, yep, bye! I'm not even gonna maybe even think this might be a trick. The doctor fiddles with the device and the screen explodes, sending out little squiggly blue electrical things. And he's like, haha, I've defeated your device. And the Valiard is like, no, it's gonna feed back into here and kill us, you idiot. And the doctor's like, oh, and just runs out, escapes. The factory explodes and little electrical bits run over the Valiard as he presumably dies. Presumably. And then the doctor runs into the trial and they're like, you're pardoned. Everything's fine. You want to be president again? Huh? Well, before that, he's also told that Perry is okay and they play some reused footage from Mind Warp, and he's very touched that she's okay, which, as stupid as it is to leave her with your Kanos, I do appreciate, like, the doctor being happy that she's okay.
Okay, but is he not concerned about her in the least? Does he not think, does she want to be stuck with your Kanos?
You don't understand. They were smiling at each other in the picture, in the footage. So it's fine. It's fine. Don't think about it. It's fine.
But BBC standards, they're married.
He's used to people. He's used to his companions marrying random dudes after knowing them for 5 minutes.
Oh, Joe.
I was thinking of Leela, actually.
Yeah, Leela.
I was thinking of Susan.
We're not saying there's a pattern here in Doctor
It goes all the way back. It's turtles all the way down.
It used to be in the 20th century, but BBC guidelines were like, if a man and a woman look each other in the eye for more than 10 seconds, that's the equivalent of foo sex. So that's why. Companions used to go around just looking at the ground, worried if they made eye contact for too long, they'd have to leave.
That shot of the two of them is from the scene right before she goes to get shaved. That's her leaving the cell.
But isn't it framed in sort of like a fuzzy?
There's like
pink
art. Mist around it. Yeah. Ugh.
Yes, it is.
So stupid.
I like to think she got married to Brian Blessed, but she still had I can't remember the character, but the other brain, and they just didn't realize.
Oh yeah, Kiv.
Yeah, still Kiv in Barry's body, just like
married to your Kanos. But yeah, then they're like, hey, do you want to be president again? Like, you're cleared, you're all free. We know you did a genocide, but presidents do that. Do you want to be president again? And he's like, nah, I think you should do it. That'd be great. You got my vote. He leaves, but he's like, just one last thing. Do whatever you want to with the master. I don't give a shit. But Glitz is probably all right. Be a little lenient on him. They leave, and Mel is like, we got to get you back on that carrot juice. And he's like, carrot juice? Maybe I should just go back and take the presidency. And then they leave, and the TARDIS fades out as he says, carrot juice, carrot juice, carrot juice.
Famous last words.
It's not exactly it's the end, but the moment has been prepared for, is it?
Right.
No. Well, the moment had not been prepared for.
No.
That is true.
So the doctor says carrot juice, carrot juice, carrot juice, and that's the last we see of him.
And then never returns.
And thus ends the Colin Baker era.
I don't know what any of you mean, because in Time of the Rani, he has a great regeneration scene. I just look knowingly at the camera now.
That's the end of Colin Baker, though. It is not the end of the serial. We get one more scene. The Inquisitor's like, everybody break up. Trial's over. Keeper, do what you need to do to restore the Matrix. Get whatever you need. And the Keeper's like, sure. And he turns around. Looks dead in the camera, and it's the Valiard, and he just, ha, 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 ha.
What does that mean? End.
Well, nothing in terms of the longevity of the show, because they never come back to it.
Just imagine how it must have looked to the other Time Lords there, where he's just like, why is the Keeper just laughing into thin air?
And it's also, like, unclear, like, do they see them? Are we just seeing him? What if it had been the other guy? Popolik. Would have it been Popolik?
That'd have been awesome.
Actually, it should have been the Rani.
It's also worth pointing out the Doctor leaves with Mel, who he hasn't met yet. Yet they're acting like well-established Doctor and companion, but he has not met her, or she hasn't met her, or however it bloody works. But
I did look it up that the Perry and Arcanos becoming wrestler and manager is in the Mind Warp novelization, thus spoiling the fact that Perry lives. Although no one's reading those in order who hasn't seen the serial, I guess. But there's a bit in the end of the Ultimate Foe novelization in which the Doctor returns Mel to her proper time.
Oh, okay.
So that he can meet her later. This is the only time you'll hear me talk about Big Finish, but during this episode, there is actually a really good serial called The Wrong Doctor, or The Wrong... I forget if it's The Wrong Doctor or The Wrong Doctors, which does serve as a real Mel introduction story, but there's two Mels and two Six Doctors, and it gets pretty crazy.
Yeah, and the Valyard does get addressed quite a bit in Big Finish. There's a lot of that showing up. And there was a what-if story early on. What if the Valyard had won the trial, basically, and he goes off as the Doctor with Mel as his companion, which is really kind of cool.
There's also a missing adventure by Craig Hinton, Millennia Rights. It's funny because the new adventure writers are based on do not touch the Valyard. Just don't bother. And Craig Hinton went, sure, okay. So he technically isn't the Valyard, but the Doctor ends up wearing something that looks a lot like the Valyard costume and acting like the Valyard, but it's not. And everyone said, all right, fine, we'll publish it.
There's also a couple of places that a final Colin Baker regeneration story is done. One of them is Big Finish in The Last Adventure, and it's a really good one. But my favorite one is a novel by Gary Russell years and years ago called Spiral Scratch, which is amazing. And it's got a hideous cover, but the story itself is literally something has scratched across all the multiverses, and the Doctor and Mel end up in all these different realities, and it's really cool. Really cool.
I would not describe anything written by Gary Russell as amazing, but
I enjoyed it. I thought it was really, execution may not have been great, but I thought the story idea was really good. I enjoyed it.
I haven't read it. I did listen to The Last Adventure, and I remember feeling very underwhelmed by it.
I kind of agree with that. I think that it could have been a lot more epic, but I think the ending, and in fact, the ending from, the actual regeneration scene, someone has taken footage from the show and sort of edit it around the audio of his regeneration scene. And it's really, really great. It ends up being a good send-off for the Sixth Doctor. It's easily findable on YouTube.
It's got to be better than Carrot Juice, Carrot Juice, Carrot Juice.
Yeah, well, yeah. Come on.
Although it is a little overwritten. I think I kind of prefer the Carrot Juice. Like, it's kind of like they're trying so hard to compensate for Carrot Juice that he talks for direction. A while.
But that's the end of The Ultimate Foe. That's the end of The Trial of a Time Lord. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for our final verdict.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Dr. Geek here with another reminder that the ESO Network is pro-science and pro-vaccine. We urge you to be a superhero and protect yourself, your family, and your fellow geeks around the world. Don't be fooled by the forces of evil and their anti-science misinformation campaign. Consult the latest CDC guidelines, your doctor, and get the COVID vaccine today.
Do you know how fast you were going?
Sorry, officer. One episode every 2 weeks?
2 weeks!
Did you also know you're carrying a dangerously heavy load?
Yes, sir, we do. We've got interviews, fight nights, film discussions, Desert Island DVDs, and lots more.
I think we've got to take you down to the station. You do not have to write anything, but it may harm the Cosmic Pizza podcast if you do not mention, when questioned, something you later wanted in the promo or feedbacks. Anything you do say may be used in said feedback.
Cosmic Pizza podcast is not about the cosmos, all about pizza.
And we are back. Tony!
Yes!
Do you know what time it is?
Is it judgment time?
Yes.
Final thoughts.
Alan, what is your final thoughts / your final verdict?
I really, really love this whole season. I know it has its problems. There could be a sense of me loving it in spite of itself, but I absolutely do love this season. And I really enjoy this last story, even though there's a lot of stuff that you can point out as problematic and, parts of it don't make any sense and parts of it don't always line up with what happened earlier in the season. But I still, I can sit down with the Blu-ray and start at the very beginning and watch the entire season straight through and love it in spite of the problems. So my verdict is, it's innocent.
Not guilty.
I don't know. Not guilty.
It seems like your verdict is that it's a guilty pleasure.
I have zero guilt about my pleasure in this scene.
Felicity, what is your final thought / verdict?
I mean, in rewatching these two episodes, they were a lot worse than I remember. I still like Mind Warp to this day, even though, yeah, there's a lot missing from the story. And yeah, the Perry resolution sucks. And I think as a whole, at the time, I was somewhat satisfied with the trial as a whole. Although I was pretty salty about Mel not getting, him meeting Mel before he actually meets Mel. Because that's the kind of continuity-obsessed person I was back then. It's less than the sum of its parts, unfortunately, as a whole, and just kind of marred by the knowledge that Colin Baker would never really get a proper send-off. And spoilers, I loathe the Sylvester McCoy era.
Oh, wow.
Oof.
Sorry.
Maybe you'll get a new appreciation from it, like, as if you, like, go along with us, maybe. Maybe not. So, but what's your final verdict? Guilty? Not guilty?
Oh, guilty. Yeah, guilty.
I'll go next. Yeah, this is a big old mess. The trial was an interesting idea, and it starts off so strong and so interestingly. And like every episode is like dropping some cool stuff, and then they all just sort of like, it just all falls apart. They have no idea what they're doing. And like, I don't blame them for it, because like some weird shit went down. You know, you had Robert Holmes die, and then you had Eric Sayward quit, and then you had 2 days to just write a script. So yeah, it makes sense why it all fell apart. I do think, just on its own, there's some like interesting ideas. There's a lot of interesting ideas in this, and there's some good scenes in this. I do like this, you know, being pulled down into the sand. I like some of the Matrix stuff. I don't super care for the 10-minute exposition dump at the beginning, but they're like every episode of Doctor Who, there's stuff to enjoy here. But mostly, it's just kind of, it's not even like it's like bad. It's not like it's like terrible to watch. It's still fun and enjoyable to watch, but it is just, none of it makes sense. It's all just, it just feels very rushed. So I would also have to say guilty. Tony, what's your final thought / verdict?
I would really love to see a version of this season that was made not in a blind panic / like apathy. Because, I mean, and it does seem like those were the two modes. Either it was people who were like, I don't know, just get it done. Or it was like, weird shit keeps happening. Because I do really like a lot of the ideas. When we started this season, I think it was like the first two, we loved them. And then everyone was kind of like, it's diminishing returns. Like, because we were like, these are interesting questions. And they're actually like having the show be on trial. That's an interesting idea. But then you gotta do something with it. You can't just be like, anyway, now we're in a old Jack the Ripper story that's not gonna have Jack the Ripper in it because of reasons. Do you know what else, too? The Valyard is one of those characters who, if you're only really into New Who, or at least this was true for me when I had like just started watching it, and you only kind of aware of Classic Who, I feel like you're still aware of, like, the Valyard and the Rani, because people are constantly, like, anytime a new character is introduced, it's like, oh, do you think it's the Valyard? It's probably the Valyard. Or, it's the Rani. That character should have been the Rani.
Constantly. Especially for, like, the first 5 years.
Yes! And from that, I kind of expected the Valyard to, like, be a bigger deal. And Christine, I think you kind of said the reason why this was, which is that the Valyard is a better piece of lore than an actual executed character.
I do want to say I think the actor's doing a good job.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's good. He's competent.
The Valyard is like one of those things that like Russell T. Davies made up for the Time War, where it sounds really evocative, but like you could never see it.
Right. But I think that really sums up a lot about this serial specifically and the whole season. Is like, yeah, the Valyard, that's an amalgamation. What a cool idea. Unless we look at it, or you know, at all.
For 60 minutes.
And then it all just kind of falls apart.
So what's your final verdict?
I would say guilty, but it deserves restorative justice instead of punitive justice.
Nice.
Wow.
All right, Adam, what's your final thoughts / verdict?
Well, I'm not quite sure what this is guilty of because I'm not sure what it's trying to do. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to repeat myself a little bit from what I said when I was talking to you guys about Vervoids, in that I am fond of this season, but I would never dare recommend it to anyone until they were in too deep to Classico to back out. There are things I like it. There are interesting ideas for all the stories. And there's a lot in these two episodes, like the idea of somebody's past being put on trial by their future. That's a really interesting idea. A kind of dark version of the Doctor who isn't the Master, and how does that make him different? That's an interesting idea. None of these things are followed through. Not a single one. But yeah, it's, I mean, to have the program essentially cancelled and then brought back, and this is what you show people. I mean, it's a hell of an opening model shot, don't get me wrong. Like, it must have looked great in 1986, that opening model shot in Mysterious Planet. And then there's this, where it's like, by the second story, they're going, ooh, did this thing really happen or didn't it? Which must actually have been really frustrating for viewers. It's easier when you've got, like, the DVDs, you can rewatch, you can find the missing footage, etc., etc. But just like, is that thing you watched, did it really happen? That must have just pissed people off. It must have done. And it's missed opportunity after missed opportunity. And I think a lot of my fondness for this comes from the fact that there are hints, as we were talking about, hints in it of what's to come. Because I take a somewhat different view of the Sylvester McCoy era, as I have a whole podcast about it. So I'm quite fond of it. And there are hints of what's about to come, you know, visually and little ideas. But is it innocent or guilty? I'd call it a mistrial. To be honest, throw it out, mistrial.
Finally, Christine, what is your final thought / verdict?
First off, this two-parter, the most interesting thing to me about it is that it is the only Doctor Who season finale that only functions as a season finale. It's very modern that way, in that, like, it is not a standalone story. Like, even the one from, like, the Key to Time is still its own kind of story, whereas, like, this is a modern finale in a lot of ways. And I do think that, like, it is impossible to judge modern finales as works on their own, but in the way that I don't think it's possible to judge, like, Avengers Endgame as a movie. It's not a movie. It's a season finale. And so, like, does this work as a finale? And, like, no, not at all. It's, like, terrible as a finale. I do think I want to echo everything that everyone else has said, because we do all agree that the problem is there's a lot of really good ideas here, and none of them pay off. It kind of lays bare the central problem of, like, the Eric Saward era of the show, which is that none of the writers are good enough for the ideas that they have. No one can execute the thing that they're trying to do. They have all these ideas about things that they should do. And it, like, goes back to, like, the Fifth Doctor and having this idea of, like, let's have conflict in the TARDIS and we'll do kind of ongoing, like, soap opera style stuff. And then, like, but they're not capable of writing that at all. And so, like, now they're doing this whole interconnected season-long story, but they're not capable of doing that, like, at all. And it's sort of interesting because it's like, well, is it guilty or innocent? But, like, what is it guilty of? And if anything, if the show is on trial, then the question is it guilty of being cancelable? Because it was on hiatus and it could have been canceled. And it's like, this is their argument that they should not be canceled. And I think in that sense, they are guilty because, yeah, this season does not deserve the next few seasons that come after it. Like, this show, it's perfectly reasonable for it to go off the air. So in that sense, it's guilty. But again, like Adam was saying, like I said earlier, there are hints of, like, the things that are about to happen. And I, like Adam, love the McCoy years, my personal favorite era of the show.
Sorry. See, I think when you say that the authors aren't living up to the ideas that they have, that's a lot of how I do feel about the McCoy era, and also that the acting can't live up to.
The acting is not the best, but also I think it's doing a very specific thing. But we'll talk about that when we come to it. But yeah, I do think, and I think Pip and Jane do get it, and that I think Pip and Jane get the thing that the show is about to learn and roll with, which is that it's a lot of fun to write Doctor Who like it's a children's show. And that is a thing that they're going to do now, like especially next season. Next season is the most Doctor Who written as a children's show. Like that's why we have Bonnie Langford. To my knowledge, that's kind of what she was known for. And Pip and Jane get it. That's why the Valiard is like a Batman villain now. It's like, and I think that that's actually really smart of them to kind of pick up on this. And it is the only thing at this point that can kind of save them. But yeah, guilty. Guilty of being cancelable.
All right. You heard it here, folks. So I think that's like 5 guilties, 1 innocent.
1 mistrial. There was a mistrial.
There was a mistrial. You're right. There was a mistrial. But before we go, I'm going to see if there's anything that you all want to plug. Christine, is there anything you want to plug?
Listen to Burn Notice if you like. Go to my website, thechrischerry.com. There's a lot of stuff that I've done that's on there. You can follow me on Twitter if you like, at Chris Cereza, C-H-R-I-S-C-E-R-E-Z-A. Yeah, that's like it. Do those things. Go, now. Read Road Trippy.
Is there anything you want to plug, Adam?
I'd like to plug my podcast about the Sylvester McCoy years, as I've been mentioned several times already. It's The Real McCoy. We're currently going through a selection of the new adventures, so you might hear me say the word looms quite often. You can find it in all the places you could normally find podcasts, and you can follow us on Twitter at @real_pod. And if you really want, you can follow me on Twitter at @AdamJClegg. I do talk a lot about Doctor Who, unsurprisingly, and my little dog sometimes, so you might get to see a picture of him, which is probably the preferred option out of anything I talk about.
Your little dog too?
Little dog too.
Felicity, anything you want to plug?
Like I mentioned, I will be at Dragon Con. I've been roped into 2 panels, so I'll be doing one with Earth Station Who about the TV movie that introduced Paul McGann, and one with Earth Station 1 talking about the Coen Brothers movie Fargo. And then I'll probably be hanging out a lot in the American Sci-Fi Classics room because my husband Kevin, co-host of the Flopcast, will be on a lot of panels there.
Sweet. This may go up after Dragon Con happens, but
that's, you're probably right. So I will have been at Dragon Con. I will have committed genocide, but it's okay.
Alan, anything you want to plug?
Well, let's see. There's my little publishing company, CosmicPress.com, K-O-Z-M-I-C Press.com. There's my Star Trek podcast, which is on, is part of the Earth Station One network. It is Earth Station Trek. And then I have a music show on YouTube called Alan's Music Room.
And if you liked this episode of the podcast, you can check out more on WatchYourAssalon.com. You can also find our podcast, our Patreon, our Amazon wish list, and more at Linktree/Watchathon. That's LinkTr.ee/Watchathon. And I again want to say special thanks to Matt Golden for sponsoring this episode and this whole
thanks,
season.
Thanks, Matt.
Golden!
You can check him out at MatthewGolden.net. And I also want to say special thanks to Vince and EL for providing us with our amazing theme song.
Thanks, Vince.
Check their music out at SoundCloud.com/VinceandEL or VinceandEL.bandcamp.com. And tune in next time when we take a look back at the Sixth Doctor in total, not just the trial, his whole era, and we'll do our Sweet 16, but I don't think they're 16 serials, but we'll look at his companions, his monsters, his villains, his companions.
Did you just say companions twice?
Did I say companions twice? Maybe.
Well, there was 2 of them.
Or is there 4? Because I might include Gareth Jenkins and Tegan, but we will do that next time. And then we'll jump into the Seventh Doctor era. Would it be weird if we just stopped? We just never did the Seventh Doctor.
We've been canceled.
We've been canceled.
The song, see, the song did nothing.
You guys did it. You all voted guilty, so now we can't do the podcast anymore.
No, even I wouldn't advocate not doing the Seventh Doctor. You gotta finish. Gotta finish what you started.
So close. But until next time, keep calm and wrestle on.
Goodbye, and I love you in a platonic, parasocial way.
And you guys say bye however you want to.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye however you want to.
Carrot juice.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the Tee Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.